Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized, and with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com, that's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
I may be crazy, but it keeps me from going insane. Waylon Jennings.
There was a chimney. There's like this pinch where it does switch back you up a ways, but then you get to this pinch where you're climbing. I guess in the 1900s, some of the early European alpinists like blew up this chimney, basically, that you could get up into. But it's 200, 300 feet where you're rock climbing, you're free soloing, essentially. Like, and what's crazy is it's really popular. So there are like dozens of people doing this at a time. Oh, it was madness, man. Like, I passed like three groups that were, you know, frozen up and freaking out because it was like, it's high consequence. Like, it's super, super technical shit. And I'm toned and like trying to move and make distance and stuff. So I'm like moving, and like, it was chaos.
I'm Doc, and this is the John Freakin' Muir Pod.
Welcome to the John Freakin' Muir Pod. Lace up those boots and sling on the pack for a romp through trails, short and long. With your host and Renaissance man, Doc, it's time to embrace the suck.
Welcome back to another week on the trail, dirt bags and hiker trash. I'm Doc, and this is the John Freakin' Muir Pod. Let's start off with a reminder. If you are enjoying the podcast, take just a minute, help us out, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you're not enjoying the pod, well, just go ahead and keep that to yourself. All right, let's get to this week's guest, a triple crowner and a contributor to the Trek. Welcome to the John Freakin' Muir Pod, Dylan Dice. How's it going, Dylan?
I'm good. Trail name is Enigma.
Enigma, we went straight for that. Okay, as my next question was, in your time on the trail, have you picked up a trail name? Obviously you have. It's Enigma. How did you come up with that? How are you given Enigma as a trail name?
That one came from the Pacific Crest Trail. Third or fourth day. I can't remember the exact locations. It's, you know, 2015 is a long time ago at this point. And with all the locations and everything. Anyway, was hiking around a guy, and it ended up being like a couple of days where we kept seeing each other and doing the leapfrog kind of thing. Like, I'd see him up ahead of me, and then I'd see him behind me, and I guess the same was going for him. I was coming up on him on a fast clip, and then he'd kind of wait around, and then somehow I'd be in front of him an hour or two later. But we never had an interaction in those like first couple of days. We just kept kind of seeing each other from a distance, and then eventually ended up at a campsite together. And he was a South African guy, and he's like, "Bro, you've been an enigma the last couple of days, bro." And I was like, "Yeah, I guess." And he's like, "Man, it's your trail name. You're an enigma." And I was like, "Well, that sticks. The shoe fits. I guess that's it."
So you're an enigma wrapped up in a riddle, tucked into a mystery.
Yeah, that's it. It's all those things, and I do have a tendency to appear and disappear on people pretty randomly. And yeah, lots of different stories, lots of different lives, seems like, at this point. So it fits. It suits me. I like it.
Your stealth game is very strong, evidently.
There's that too, for sure. Yeah.
Nice. Now, you mentioned you're trying to remember where this took place back in 2015. You said that was a lot of trails ago. That was like a different lifetime, right? 2015. If you think of what has transpired in the world since 2015, it's mind-boggling.
It is. And it seems like that was just kind of the start of the time when the trails were really picking up in popularity too. You know, it's like, I mean, there was probably 300 or 400 people that finished the PCT that year. And like, what is it now? It's got to be close to AT numbers. It's getting up there in the thousands in a good year. This year might be different with all the snow up there, but you know, in a decent year, there's a lot of people out there. And we were noticing that, you know, I was running into trail vets while I was out there, and they were saying, yeah, it's already starting to happen. This was a couple of years after the Cheryl Strayed, the Wild movie came out. So, you know, it was a bunch of people that had seen that and kind of gotten the inspiration from that. And then it just blew up. Like, it got crazy. And for better or worse, I guess, it's great that people are getting outside, but it's yeah, there's a lot of foot traffic out there now.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you had an idea of what the catalyst might have been that to cause all this traffic on the PCT. And I have my own guess, which was the book and later the movie, Wild by Cheryl Strayed. I remember very vividly driving my daughter up to college in Southern Oregon. And during that trip, I stayed with her for a couple of days. I was reading the book, Wild, and hadn't seen the movie. I read the book first, and then later I saw the movie. But it seems to me anyway that was a huge catalyst in the foot traffic on the PCT.
I think you're right. And right around that time, like, Instagram was starting to really blow up too. You know, some of the social media sites were getting really popular. Facebook was opening up to wider audiences. And besides like the PCT side of it, like, I think a lot of people started seeing the Triple Crown option, you know, and folks that were starting out slow or something, you know, doing the AT journey were like, you know, there's this other thing that, you know, go out and do the PCT. And then they had, you know, the PCT is so much fun. It's like, well, you gotta be a Triple Crowner. You can't just do two and leave the third, like, for a lot of minds, you know. So I think social media had a part to play in it too, you know, just the accessibility to what other people are doing out there, and seeing that there's these options in this culture around the trails. It's like a lot of fun.
Yeah. Now the AT pretty popular too. I mean, it is adjacent to a lot of trail towns. There's a lot of traffic on the AT. It's close to population centers in a lot of places. The foot traffic is not picking up on the PCT, getting more popular. If you are an experienced hiker and you're looking for a more solitary experience, not as crowded, any recommendations on that?
For the US, it's definitely the CDT or something smaller. Even those trails are starting to pick up, though. The PNT, I think there might have been 100 people the year I hiked that, which was 2019, you know, just a few years ago. I know the Hey Duke is another one that's definitely going to pick up in a lot of popularity, but still the numbers are small. So it's those other options, not the big three that will give you a little bit more of an experience. And you know, some of my friends have gotten really into doing those and kind of focusing on those. I think of like Mega Man, Wes Willis, who's out there doing things like the Triple O trails, the Ochiata, you know, doing Arkansas and Missouri. And I think this year he's setting off on something that's parallel to the CDT, but not on the CDT, so he can, you know, experience the wilderness. So you can get creative like that. Larry Boy's another guy who's out there doing cool stuff that gets you into unique places. And
yeah, Wesley Tills,
Mega Man.
One of my favorite stories. I had him on as a guest, and he told me about his experience. His episode title was called "The Runaway Missionary."
He
discovered his love for hiking while he was doing his mission, and he actually left his mission. And the legend behind that continues to grow.
I got the full story on that. I hiked with him a bit on the Appalachian Trail, and then we were hiking the CDT the same year, though we never really met up on that one. I was behind him in the logs, but yeah, he's a riot, man. He tells great stories. It gets himself into some too, for sure.
Now, yeah. Enigma, you mentioned you thought maybe the Hayduk traffic was going to be picking up. Hayduk is more of a route, right? It's not a well-marked or clearly defined trail. There's a lot of wayfinding involved with
it. But there is also a guidebook printed out, you know, with step-by-steps, and there's map sets, and there's a culture around it, and there's an attraction to being out in the places in Utah, you know, in that Abbey country, that back country through the Redstone and stuff, that is incredibly drawing to a lot of people. So I think that one's really gonna pick up in popularity, especially as the route gets really well established and, you know, finalized, and which it's well on its way at this point. It's just a matter of, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what happens with it. I know two people that are hiking it this spring. I'm intending to go out either in the fall this year or maybe spring of next year. I had it scheduled for 2020, right before the pandemic got serious.
I was talking to Missing Spoons just the other day, and he has kind of evolved from doing the well-established trails to doing more route finding, doing more trails that are routes rather than trails. And so he talked about the Grand Enchantment trail, which is in that vein. He just came off the Winter Through hike, which was a lot of kind of route finding. So it was interesting to hear his perspective as well. I'll talk about not being on the well-traveled footpath and running into a lot of people. He was by himself for days, weeks at a time.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's impressive. And I think that's for a lot of the folks who've, you know, done some of the major trails, that's kind of the next logical progression is to start moving into making your own routes, especially if you like the independence and the wilderness aspect of it, being one with the wilderness. Mm-hmm. There are definitely some of us that like the culture, and you know will stick to the major trails because there are other people on there, and they're the villages and the hostels, and you know there's a community around the whole thing. But yeah, for some people it's about testing their abilities and really pushing themselves into being one with nature, and that becomes harder and harder to do, you know, with it in modern times. The wilderness is all but gone, so you know that's all the more attraction for folks like Little Spoons and Mega Man and Larry Boy and those out there that are doing that kind of thing. It's super cool. I don't know if I'm going to move into that realm or not. Well, hard to say. There's still trails to hike, you know.
You may fall in love with a Hayduk, and it may be a shift for you.
It's true. It's true. And there's some other international stuff that I really want to get after too. So
okay, yeah, we're going to be spending some time in Europe tonight as we're talking.
Yeah,
stories in a little bit. But Enigma, have you listened to the podcast before?
Once to listen to a buddy. I apologize.
No, that's okay.
I'll listen to more. No pressure here.
Just wanted to make sure that, you know the format of the show, that we have a segment towards the end called the Pro Tip Insight of the Week, where I will turn to you and ask you to share some trail wisdom with our listeners to make their next outdoor experience even better. So don't be surprised.
Okay, good to know.
Okay. And feel free to drop trail wisdom throughout the episode, but you will be on the hook for that one at the end.
All right.
The must bring gear review.
Hey, Enigma, another feature we've been doing this season is the must bring gear review, sponsored by the ultralight backpacking gear company Six Moon Designs. Here's how it works. If you were to let a stranger pack your bag with pretty much generic gear for a multi-day, multi-week, multi-month hike, what is the one specific piece of gear you would insist on being packed? And if you've got a particular brand for that specific piece of gear, even better. So Enigma, what do you have to have out there on the trail with you?
I mean, shelter for sure. Does it have to be a piece of gear that I own, or can it be any piece of gear? There's some that I've tested that I don't own that I might like consider.
Yeah. I mean, if somebody were packing your bag and they're throwing in just, you know, any old tent, any old, sleeping bag, you know, everything in there, but you're going to say, you know what, I really want to have this on this trip. So any piece of gear is fair game.
Well, I mean, I'm just going to go with what I know, because it seems like there's so many good options out there, and I really haven't put to the test, and shelter is so key. What I know and what's been working for me really, really well for the last 3-4 seasons at this point, haven't had it my entire hiking career, but I've been using the Pro Trail setup from Tarp Tent, which is a one-person, essentially a tarp shelter, but a little different. I think Tarp Tent's been around for, gosh, probably 2 or 3 decades or more. He's been a cottage industry shelter maker for quite some time at this point. And that just means that it's dialed in. You know, his models have been tested and approved and tweaked and made so that they're as good as they get. And I really like the Pro Trail. It's got a sizable vestibule that you can fit your wet stuff out in, or your backpack. I tend to take my backpack on the inside and lean it against my trekking pole that works as the, you know, support system, so that it kind of puts more pressure on it to give it more tension and gives me a little bit of a pillow kind of set up with my backpack inside. But if things are wet, they go out in the vestibule. It's got tons of space. It's got bug netting and a tub underneath, so you know it weighs in at, like, I think it's 12 ounces 14 ounces, something like that. It's under a pound, so nice. it's not the lightest model on the market, but it's damn good. It's extremely lightweight. It would be considered ultralight. I think people do consider it ultralight. And the price point is right on it too. I think new they run like $200, $250. Wow. I got mine from a friend, Magpie, actually. Magpie and Constantine. I think you might have talked to Constantine at some point too. I hiked with them on the Pacific Northwest Trail, and Magpie was getting a new tent after that one, and I had seen her in the Pro Trails, like, that looks like a freaking sweet tent, and she was getting rid of it because she's getting a new one, gave it to me for under $100. So
wow, like, that's a steal right there.
It's a good deal. But even new, they're a good deal, and they're a good tent. And I've put it through some shit too, you know. It through the wind and the rain tests and everything, and it holds strong.
Sounds like it checks a lot of boxes there. Lightweight, affordable, durable. If you've been lugging it around out there for 3-4 years.
Yeah. And just this summer, this last summer, it started leaking a little bit. And I think just a little seam seal on that, slap that on, and it'll be just fine again. You know, it's going to hold up. And yeah, like you said, I feel like with most gear, there's that 3 checklist system. It's got to be 2 of the 3, either good price, good durability, or
Lightweight
consideration. And it's hard to find two of the three, but it's almost impossible to find three of the three. And I feel like this is one of those that's three out of checks all the boxes, you know. Okay.
Give us an idea. What was your base weight on your Triple Crown trails? Did it vary from trail to trail?
Oh yeah, it varied for sure. Going into the PCT, I had to be pushing like 45 pounds on that going into it. I had an old REI bag, you know, like I just had a bunch of older gear that was not ultralight, not lightweight even for the most part. So, you know, struggled, tweaked things, saw what other hikers were doing, got a little bit better for the next hike on the AT, switched up the backpack, you know, got a ULA, which I still use. And, you know, just one by one, changing gear out, getting lighter and lighter. And these days I hover, I'm not an ultralight hiker. I've never really considered myself an ultralight hiker. Light hiker, but not ultralight. I can't get into the single digits. That's next to impossible for me. I have too many luxuries. So these days it's between 18 and 25 for base weight. So
okay. I love to hear that, because what that tells people is that if you're waiting for the right set of gear to get out there onto the trail, if you want to have it completely dialed in before you do anything, I mean, that's just an excuse not to go hiking. gear should not be what's holding you up. You know, you took a 40 pound kit out and did the PCT, and you know, you dial it in as you go. You make some, you know, adjustments along the way. You change out pieces here and there until you feel good about what's on your back, but don't let that be the reason why you're not out there hiking.
You're absolutely right. That's a very, very, very good point. It's, you know, the way I think about it is like, the guys that were doing the AT in the 60s and 70s, like they were carrying 50 pound bags. Like there's, you know, and if they could do it, we can do it. I think it's just purely luxury to get the ultralight. It's great for the body, and it's, you know, it makes hiking oh so much easier to have a lighter setup, but you know, it's okay to go slower, take your time, enjoy the scenery. Like, And definitely you're going to learn things from other hikers. You're going to see what works and what doesn't work. You're going to see what you like and like, oh, that's a cool pot setup on, you know, I like that pot and that koozie that you got. What'd you do to, where'd you find that? What is that? You know, that's going to happen for hikers all the time, everywhere you go. So it's, and especially for those of us who have a smaller budget, don't make a lot of money. You kind of do have to take your time. You can't just jump in with an ultralight kit because it's expensive, exorbitantly expensive.
Yeah.
So for me, it's like I'll treat myself to one or two new pieces of gear every season, and just kind of one by one work my way towards the ideal setup for me. And sometimes that one is a replacement for something that broke, or, you know, the Therm-a-Rest that busted out some battens, or, you know, has too many leaking holes in it, or, you know, sometimes it's a must replace, but
right,
more often than not, it's a, like, this year I'm going to do it back, you know, or this yeah. year I'm going to get a new stove and try some new setup out.
All right. Well, hey, Enigma, we're gonna talk a little bit more about gear here. And to help us do that, we've got...
It's the hiking pole.
The hiking pole. And that's pole spelled P-O-L-L, like a survey, not like the thing in your hand. This is actually a 7-question survey that's going to help me assign you a score on the sanity scale from 1 to 100.
With all right.
1 being completely insane and 100 being completely sane. Now, I just have to warn you ahead of time that... because you are a Triple Crowner, there's an automatic 30-point deduction. So the highest score you can get is 70.
Okay.
All right. There's already a deduction because you spent a fair amount out there on the trails, and that says something about you.
Does that make me more insane or more correct. Sane?
No. It makes you more insane. One is completely insane. So.
Okay. Let's lower the score down. Let's see where we can.
Yeah, where do you think you're going to fall?
50 or less, hopefully.
Okay. Hopefully. hoping to shoot low. Gotcha. All right. Question number one. Easy one. Trekking poles or no trekking poles out there?
I'm a one pole hiker.
Oh, already you're being difficult. It's not one or the other. It's one pole. Got it.
It's one. Yeah. Yeah. It's always been one pole. I can't do two poles and I can't do no poles because my shelter requires it. And I just like having a free hands. I like having, you know, one for the tripod effect to get the grip on the ground and the extra balance, but one to grab my camera, snacks, water bottle, do stuff with, you know, it's just nice to have some freedom.
You know, that's a good point. Inevitably, I will stop to get a snack or do something out there, and I've got two poles, and one of the poles will fall onto the ground, right? And I'll have to spend some time figuring out how I'm going to pick that dang pole up.
Maybe you should think about joining the one pole crew. There's quite a few of us out there. I'm surprised that you haven't heard that yet.
I've heard it a couple of times. But
All right. Yeah, there's definitely a few of us out there, and it seems to be the ones who have been in it for a while.
Okay. All right. Question number two: what's on your feet, boots or trail runners?
Trail runners, for sure.
He looks at me with, if you're not watching this on YouTube, that look he just gave me, like, is that even a question? I mean, what's going on there? So did you early on in your hiking career, and did you start off in boots and then make the transition to trail runners, or
from the get-go? When I was a kid, I was wearing hiking boots. I was in the Boy Scouts and did quite a bit of hiking as a youth, and I definitely wore hiking boots back then. But no, since I've been hiking long distance, it's been trail runners.
Okay. Question number three. When it comes to shelter, this would be interesting. Tent, tarp, hammock, bivy, or cowboy camping? What's your preference?
Tarp. We're going to go with tarp. I want to say cowboy camping, but I do like having protection. You know, on a nice night, it's cowboy camping. But like, yeah, no, I got to go with tarp just as an all around.
Okay. Now, when you were describing your tarp tent earlier, I mean, you said it had a tub, it had bug netting. And so is that really considered a tarp or is that a tent?
I don't know. That's a very good question. I think some people would consider it a tarp because it doesn't have an internal framework, doesn't have poles. You use your trekking poles and you use guy lines to give it tension. So it's got that tarp tendency, but if a normal person who's only done a couple of days worth of camping walked up to it, they'd probably call it a tent. So it's one of those like real in the middle things.
Yeah. I mean, it's got both in the name. So that's confusing. Tarp tent.
That's in the brand. Yeah. And yeah. That's all of their styles. It's like Z packs, you know, and Six Moon Designs, all of them, they kind of walk that line where it's like, it's made a tarp material. It's not, but it's not technically a tarp.
Are there multiple ways to set up the tarp tent?
I mean, yes, with the amount of guidelines and stuff, yes. Yeah. I could rig it to two trees or two, you know, two high points with and take out the pole structure that you
I think maybe the defining characteristic of a tarp is that you can pitch it in many different ways. I mean, there's the A-frame, there's the shovel or the, there's the asymmetrical Holden. There's, you know, there's different ways to set up. There's no internal structure that's going to limit how you can set it up.
Sure. And with the tarp tent, there's two ways to set it up. You set it up with poles or you set it up hanging from trees. There's a
is basically the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Got it. Okay. Question number four. When it comes to your sleep system, are you sleeping bag or quilt?
I'm a sleeping bag.
Oh.
I haven't jumped into the quilt game. That's one of those pieces of gear that's kind of expensive that I just haven't prioritized yet. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I love these questions. I may be giving away the game here, but I love these questions because some of these questions, there's point deductions no matter how you answer. I mean, if you're a quilt guy, you're like, okay, that's a little bit extra, you know, maybe you're gonna lose a couple points. But if you're just still doing a sleeping bag, I mean, what's up with that? So I don't know that there's a right answer. I'm just it's interesting to hear people's justification for why they do what they do out there.
Sure. I would go with a quilt for lightweight. It's just a matter of expenses and priorities right now for me. The sleeping bag is comfortable. It's kept me warm. Never been super cold. It's a 20 degree bag.
Down or synthetic?
Synthetic.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, when it comes to food, are you a stove guy, cold soak or stoveless?
Well, almost always it's been a stove. This last summer I went stoveless. So
how did you enjoy that experience?
Well, Europe is a little different than the United States in that you're going through, you have accessibility to towns as frequently as you want. So it's not, you don't ever really have to carry a whole lot of food.
It's a pub at the end of every day, right?
Essentially. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's very legitimate. A pub or a hut or a chalet or something that has alcohol.
What am I doing hiking in America? I Europe is on brand for me. I need to get over there.
Yeah, we'll get more into that. But no, yeah. It's absolutely outstanding in that regard. And then the fact that, like, especially in like France and Spain, you have incredibly good cheese. Hard sausage, hard meats, so like, and not like overly processed meat. It's like farm to table kind of meat, and you know, dried in a barn somewhere for a couple of years. You know, it's legit as it gets, and like and fresh bread and you just, you know, you strap a baguette to the side of your backpack and carry out some sausage and cheese. And man, I could eat that breakfast, lunch and dinner for days. Like, you can get your staples like couscous and oats and stuff like, you know, trail mix and all the other cold soak, goodness. So it was not hard to cold soak and having done that, I would do it again. I really like coffee though, so I found myself missing that at times in the places where I couldn't get to a cafe or a chalet.
You can't even have iced coffee in Europe because they don't have ice.
No, but they have these really cool things called 3-in-1 that are like instant. There's a whole bunch of different kinds of them, and I think they were originally out of Russia. But now you find them all over Europe. And it's like it's powdered milk, sugar, and coffee. And in a little tube, a tube thing, and you pour it and mix it up. And yeah, it's instant, so you can do it with the cold water too.
Okay. Now Enigma, I really like the trail name culture that, you know, we assign trail names to people. So I've taken to using that with the podcast here. I'm always on the lookout for the trail name of the episode, you know, something funny that comes up, something that resonates with me, some funny thing that happens. Your use of the word legit, just a minute or two ago, you were really emphatic with the legit cuisine over there. That might be the trail name for this episode. It might be legit with Enigma. We'll see. We'll see how it goes.
We'll see. Okay. Yeah. I like it. All right.
Question
you
number
got some more questions. Yeah.
So two more questions. Question number six, is life better above or below the tree line?
Above. Yeah, for sure. Above. Yeah.
No point deduction there. That's the correct answer.
All right. Glad to hear it.
All right. And last question, what's more important, pack weight or luxury items?
For me, luxury items.
And can you give us an example of maybe what luxury items we might find in your bag?
Holy shit. Yeah. I mean, I often carry a book or two. I carry a journal. I carry a watercolor set and colored pencils. A couple of trails. I carried some magic cards. like Magic the Gathering, the old card game. I carried that. That was one of my PCT luxury items that added to that 45-pound pack weight. Carried two decks so that I could, you know, play if somebody played the game, I had one for them so that I could, you know, actually play somebody, because who else is going to be carrying Magic cards on a long distance through, like, not many. Come to find out,
your score is dropping by the minute here.
That's all right. I'm okay with that. I mean, also in international travels, you got to carry some documents with you. I carry paperwork that's, you know, travel insurance and some of the visa items and itineraries, bits and, you know, bits and stuff to keep sane while traveling. I mean, the last couple of years I've carried a solar charger. It's like a brick. It's actually right here. It's a brick. It alone weighs almost a pound on its own. It
weighs more than your tarp tent, that's for sure.
It does, actually.
Okay. Well, thank you for letting us take a peek inside your bag and all that's in there. Bear with me. I've got to do some math. We're going to take your answers. We're going to put it through the John Freaking Mirpod algorithm, and we're going to come up with a score here. So I need to, let's say, I got to carry the 3. We're going to divide by root 3. We're going to multiply by pi, and I'm going to adjust for the room temperature of a European pub while you're eating some legit food.
Yeah.
And I come up with the score of 43.
All right. I made it under 43. 50. Yeah.
You made it. Congratulations.
Yeah. Might not be the craziest one out there, but certifiable probably at this point.
Yeah. And you know what? The score can adjust up or down throughout the episode here. So, I mean, that's not set in stone. That's just my initial impression.
Here, let me take a couple more points off. I do forgot another one of the luxury items. I tend to pick up, I studied geology in college. I tend to pick up rocks.
You're carrying rocks in your bag. That's like you're now in the 30s, Enigma. You're now in the 30s.
I try and keep them real small, you know, like quarter size or less. But there have been exceptions for sure.
This episode might be carrying rocks with Enigma.
it's another one. Let's not go with that, because that's could be questionable depending on how you interpret that.
That's right. Okay. Hey, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to hear from the sponsors. When we come back, we're going to get into, I want to hear a little bit about your background, Enigma, and how you got involved in through hiking. And then we're going to venture off to Europe to talk about some of these trails over there that sound pretty darn appealing. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
From the backcountry to the backyard, we believe everyone deserves the highest level of protection. Since 1984, Sawyer Products offers the best, most technologically advanced solutions for protection against sun, bugs, and water, using time-released liposome technology, topical insect repellents, and new standards in water filtration. And with every Sawyer product you buy, you are helping to provide clean water through 140 charities in 80 countries with their long-lasting water filters. Every Sawyer product you buy is an investment in our common humanity. Choose Sawyer and keep the adventure going, knowing that their products have been tested and chosen by those who count on serious protection on the trail all day long. Six Moon Designs has been innovating ultralight backpacking gear for the past 20 years. With a wide range of products ranging from ultralight shelters to backpacks and accessories like their extensive line of trekking umbrellas, Six Moon Designs is sure to have a great piece of gear for your needs. With the company philosophy being that gear should aid one's experience, not define it, Six Moon Designs thinks the more time people spend outside the natural world, the better off this world will be. And remember, go wild, live young. This episode is sponsored by Jolly Gear. Are you tired of compromising between the ventilation of a button-down and the full protection of a sun hoodie? With the Triple Crown button-down, you can have the best of both. plus their fun standout patterns will have you the talk of the trail. Visit them at jollygear.com. Through hiker owned, Jolly Gear, where fun meets functional. Want to make a podcast? Spotify's got a platform that lets you make one super easily, then distribute it everywhere and even earn money, all in one place for free. It's called Spotify for Podcasters, and here's how it works. Spotify for Podcasters lets you record and edit podcasts right from your phone or computer, so no matter what your setup is like, you can start creating today. Then you can distribute your podcast to Spotify and everywhere else podcasts are heard. Video podcasts are also available on Spotify. With Spotify for Podcasters, you can earn money in a variety of ways, including ads and podcast subscriptions. And best of all, it's totally free with no catch. Since I discovered Spotify for Podcasters, I feel like my creativity has raised to another level. I highly recommend you give it a try. Download the Spotify for Podcasters app or go to www.spotify.com/podcasters to get started.
Welcome back. We are talking to Dylan Dice, aka Enigma, and just went through the hiking pole. Fascinating look into the bag of Enigma. And
I'm a little embarrassed, better or worse.
We're here we are. And I'd love Dylan to hear about how you know where you grew up, what's your background, how involved in the outdoors were you as a kid growing up, and how did you get involved in this whole thing called thru hiking?
Sure. So I grew up in Colorado, up in the mountains outside of Denver, a little ways. I was in the Boy Scouts and ended up doing quite a bit of hiking with the Boy Scouts. Went to Philmont and went up into the Boundary Waters a couple of times up in Ely, and definitely got into it then. Did quite a bit of backpacking with my dad and my family as well. He's a hobby geologist as well, so we'd go out looking for cool stuff up in the mountains and do little week-long trips sometimes, or, you know, mostly weekend trips. He had to work and stuff too, but like, yeah, so got pretty into the outdoors at that point.
So it sounds like you have some strong roots in backpacking. You've done this for a while, since you were a kid.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the biggest long distance hiking trip, we did the 50 mile in Philmont. I did a 30 mile weekend trip in a summer camp. That must have been like seventh or eighth grade, somewhere around there. So it was, it's already kind of doing some long-ish distance mm-hmm. trips, you know. More
Any
than
siblings?
Just your back.
Any siblings in
I do have a younger sister. She's not too into being out there. Ironically, she just recently moved to a town that's on the Pacific Northwest Trail. The trail goes through her backyard pretty much. So
that's a good excuse to either visit her or do the trail.
Well, I've done the trail. It would be a good excuse to go back and run some trail magic for people, though. And I'm trying to convince her and her boyfriend into getting involved with the trail magic culture. They're in a prime spot for it.
I always find it very interesting that siblings grew up in the same household, same family, same types of activities, and one becomes a thru hiker and one is like, not in my worst
nightmare. Yeah, that'll happen. It's not for everybody, that's for sure.
Yeah. Now you mentioned earlier about things can get expensive and not everybody has the money to purchase these things. What are you doing to finance these adventures? How do you pay the bills these days?
Well, these days I'm not doing much to finance. It's gonna be a while before my next adventure because I'm not working too much right now. At the moment, I'm working in the grape industry. There's a lot of vineyards around where I work, so it's vineyard work, pruning and planting and walking the vineyards, and eventually it'll be the harvest and stuff like that. But Through the winter is when you do the pruning of the vines. So that's what I've been doing. These days, it pays less than minimum wage. It's not much.
Yeah.
Before
any desire to be a sommelier?
No, and I don't want to go to school for that. And what the wine culture is, I'd be into like making wine, but I don't want to be like the guy that's like talking about it.
Did you ever see that Netflix series called Somm? It follows these four or five guys as they are studying for the sommelier test. And the things that it's worse than studying for the bar exam. I mean, these guys were under the gun, so much stress, so much pressure. And then, you know, part of the test is they give you multiple glasses of wine and you're supposed to taste them. And from that taste, be able to identify the region of the world, you know, what time of the year it was grown. What are the, you know, what hints of oak and whatever else in the wine. I mean, it was just mind boggling.
I took some classes in college around wine. I was studying soil sciences, and I mentioned earlier I was doing geology, but it ended up being into soil sciences, and was thinking about going into the wine industry. With the terroir kind of stuff, you taste the soil has a major influence on what kind of grapes you can grow and the flavors that they take on. But we watched a video and there was something about like they did this test with this chemical in water that they would have people taste, and I guess 98 out of 100 people just didn't taste anything. It tasted like water. And then like 2% could like taste that there was something a little funky about the water, but like it wasn't bad or whatever. There was just a slight funk to it. And like point
like
one
water out of a cistern in New Mexico on the CDT.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Off of the AZT with a little bit of that squirrel note to it. Yeah. But then there's 0.1% that would like drink it and spit it out because it was just so acrid, so bad. And I guess that 0.1% are the people that have what it takes to be a sommelier, to be able to like taste every little fine note, you know, and describe it all and that kind of thing. And so it's not something I'm interested in. I love making alcohol and will continue to pursue that path. I was getting to that before I left last summer for a couple of years. I was working in a brewery, a local brewery, as an assistant brewer. I came back, there was some drama involved, and I've decided I'd rather keep my friendships with the people that left the brewery than go back and lose some connections around here, some people I like being around. So I am not going to work back at that craft brewery. There's another one opening up down the road. I'm going to see if I can get some work down there. Conversation with a good friend about moving into wine and mead. I did a lot of mead making in college and got pretty good at making that. And doing some maple syrup right now. So
now,
that
what
might
is the
be...
difference, Enigma? What is the difference between wine and mead?
Mead uses honey for the fermentable sugar, and wine uses dextrose sugar, like normal processed sugar. So
would you make that in your dorm room?
Yeah, well, it was a duplex. I moved into a duplex with another brewer, and we set up our water closet with the water heater in it, with this amazing shelving system, so that we could put our 5-gallon carboys up on the top shelf and just gravity feed them into the secondaries, and then gravity feed them into bottles. And we were way above our legal limit. And in those years we were doing, I mean, probably 50 gallons at a time, and the legal limit's 100 gallons a year per adult, up to two adults. So we could do 200 gallons in a year, and we pushed above that, I'm sure.
That duplex was the place to be on the weekends, huh?
Oh man, we did all right. It was we were quite popular amongst those who enjoyed what we were making, and My roommate was better with the beers, and I was better with the meads. And we both did meads. He had some creative takes, but his beer game was way better than mine. I've gotten better, but so is he. He's still doing. He's working in microbreweries, I think, on the West Coast somewhere. Yeah, no, that was something. And I guess what else was I doing? In the early years of through hiking, I was working my winter months in the ski industry. I was doing lift operations. So kind of a perfect job for a hiker, a through hiker, because you can get off trail and when it starts to get cold and get the job on the ski hill. And, right. And then you lose the job in April. Because the ski hills close up and the snow melts, so it's
time your to job, and then you go hiking. It's perfect.
And then you're loaded, and you go hiking. Yeah, if you're smart about how you do it, and don't party too hard, you can walk away with a good chunk of change, enough to do a hike.
Yeah,
for sure. So
now let's pack our bags. Let's go over to Europe now, and let's talk about the HRP. In fact, my last guest mentioned that he had done the HRP. We didn't spend a whole lot of time on it. I just mentioned it kind of in passing. So let's talk about that. What is the HRP? Where is it?
The HRP is the Haute Route Pyrénées. It's the Pyrenees High Route. It's spelled with an H. It's a French pronunciation there. It's a trail that starts on the Atlantic coast on the French-Spanish border. On the Spanish side, you have the city of Irún, which was made famous by Ernest Hemingway. He's a local hero out there. He spent a lot of time up there. So if you read Hemingway, you probably know about Irún.
He knows his way around a beer too.
He sure does. You know, and the wine out there. There's and he's popular in the bars for sure. And then on the French side of the border is Ende, which is where the GR10 starts, as well as the HRP. They start at the same spot on a beach in Ende, which is spelled H-E-N-D-A-Y-E. That's Ende. And then you walk along the Pyrenees High Route. You stay close to the crest, and then you end up on the Mediterranean coast. And you follow the Spanish-French border for that entire time. You cross through the tiny little country or republic. It's technically a country of Andorra, and which is an impenetrable mountain fortress. It's a tiny little country, but on all sides are these massive granite peaks and walls. It's a very, very cool little country. In the basins,
sounds like something out of Tolkien.
It is straight out of Tolkien. It's a straight out of Middle Earth for real. Valleys and wizards and hobbits and mountains and Mordor, and you're close to the coast. You're getting closer to the Mediterranean, and it gets hot down there. And yeah, it's a wild world out there. There were many times in the Pyrenees where it's like, I am in Middle Earth. This is like. With the people up there doing the goats and sheep and the wine and like just the landscapes and the transition from landscapes going through like the Basque country and these rolling green hills into like these just jagged Sierra like mountains. It's just unreal. And then there were parts that's like, man, it's like where they're going into the Mines of Moria, like, oh shit, the Ruiners of Rohan are coming around the corner here. You know, there's just like all these like spots that like, and I've been to New Zealand too and spent some time down there. So I did get to see the Middle Earth, quote unquote, but like the Pyrenees have it in contention. Peter Jackson could have filmed down there just fine. And it would have been okay.
Like, well, it's nice. It's nice talking to a fellow fan. I read Lord of the Rings, the complete set, when I was a kid, when I was like maybe 14 years old. And I decided just this past year, like in the last 6 months, that I read it again. I downloaded it onto my Kindle and read the whole thing again. And it was even better the second time. I appreciate talking to someone who knows this stuff.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I've read it a few times myself, and The Hobbit probably 15 or 20 times. I mean, that was my favorite book growing up. So it's for sure in my psyche all the time.
So but how long is the HRP?
The HRP, it was 465 and a half miles for me, and that's based off of my daily journaling accounts off of I followed the guidebook by Tim. Oh God, I have to find his name on my notes. The Cicerone guidebook. So the thing about the HRP is that it very, it also, I guess we mentioned this before with the Via Dinarica, it's a lot like the CDT in that there's some options. There's different takes on the official route. And if you want like an even lower route, but still a Pyrenees experience, there's well-marked trails. The GR10 is on the French side, and the GR11 is on the Spanish side. And the GR trails in Europe are super well-established, well-blazed. There's an infrastructure. There's a culture around it. You'll see people. You'll have community. The HRP overlapped with both of those trails numerous times. But in between, it became route finding. It became a very like CDT kind of experience where it was you're following cairns and going off of a variety of the IGN French topographic maps. And I was using the map set that came with the Cicerone guidebook. When you buy the guidebook, you get a GPX accessibility to the GPX files online. And it's a good setup. It was incredibly worthwhile to have that because it was accurate for the most part. I think there was only once or twice where it was like, I think the actual route might be a little off over that way, but it was obvious enough. And there were times where it was under snow, so it was following the red line was hard because I couldn't see the path.
Yeah, now I know you started at the beach and then you ascend into the Pyrenees.
Yes.
And
yeah.
Do you stay up there and do like, you know, a lot of ridge walking, or is it kind of up and down?
It's a lot of ups and downs. There are some ridge walking, and a couple of the other guidebooks out there, I guess, have more of that. There's a German guidebook and a French guidebook, and I met hikers using both of them, and we would compare notes and like, oh wow, you went away over on that, like you followed that ridge line where I came down and went back up kind of thing. So there are different takes on it, and it's one of those that it's almost a good idea to hike it once following an official route and then hike it again with a topographic map, you know, with all the trails, and just kind of go at it the way you want to. I met a couple of Czech hikers, and I'd like to mention their names because they're worth looking into. Kubo is Kubo J9, K-U-B-O J9 on Instagram, and his buddy is Fiki on the road, underscores in between all of those words, F-I-K-I on the road. And they were a couple of Czech guys that were going the opposite way as me. So they started on the Mediterranean, going towards the Atlantic, and we stayed the night together. And it was one of the very few times where it felt like the hiker trash culture in the U.S. You know, it was a rundown shelter, and we both like showed up as it was getting dark, and you know, quickly threw up our random tent setups, tarp setups, and cooked over our stoves and shared some stories and stuff. And they had some stories, and I had some stories, and it was one of those. It felt very through hiker, and it was a really really cool moment. Turns out that those guys were doing a real high route. They were doing a lot of ridge lines, ascents, getting up high and staying high as much as they possibly could. And I think they might have been again using a guidebook as a basis, but then kind of looking at the maps every day and saying like, I think we can go up this trail instead and stay high and meet back up with our route over here kind of thing. So they did a really cool route. For me, it was following the Cicerone style, which if you follow it day by day, it has you ending in a hut or a chalet every night. You have a roof over your head. place to eat. Most of those places have food, dinner for sale, as well as bedding. So you could do it day by day. I ended up breaking it up and spending a lot of nights in between stages so that I could sleep in my tent and be in the, you know, the Alpine experience. But still, what was it? I'm trying to find my amount.
While you're looking for that, Enigma, if you were going to do the Cicerone style and go chalet to chalet, I mean, what would you need to carry with you? I mean, if you've got, you know, bedding's taken care of, food's taken care of, I mean, what are you carrying in your bag with you? And what would your base weight be?
It would be almost like a Camino journey where when people do the Camino, and especially if they're doing just Spain or just Portugal kind of thing, all you really need is a change of clothes, extra socks, rain gear, water bottles. I mean, that's really about it. A first aid kit, like, and even that, like, a lot of people leave behind. In the Pyrenees, you would want a first aid kit. There's a lot that can go wrong. And I think it would be a bad idea to go without a tent and sleeping bag, because it is rugged enough that you could get caught in between places to stay pretty easily. There were a number of nights where I got caught before a ridgeline. You know, it was getting late in the day and the thunderstorm rolled up, and I just couldn't go up and over to get to the hut that I was planning to get to that day. And it was just on the other side kind of thing, but not, you know, when it turns into boom room up there, you want to stay low. And, you know, there might be an option to turn around and go way back, but your descents on the HRP, especially in the thick of the Pyrenees, you're going up 2000 feet, 3000 feet at a time, just to descend 2000, 3000 feet, just to go back up. And you'll do that 3 and 4 times in a day. I still haven't found my number, but the amount of ascent was, I want to say it was like hiking up Everest 7 or 8 times from sea level. Like it's over 200,000 feet of elevation gain. Like it's a crazy amount of gain and loss. You're going up and down and up and down, and some of it's crazy, crazy, crazy steep. Like a pitch of 40 to 45 degrees, you know, where you're scrambling like class 3, 3.5 scrambles, where you're on your hands and feet.
Your one hiking pole.
And your one hike, like in that situation, I strapped it to my pack. Like
they didn't think to put switchbacks there for you. It's straight up and down.
Yeah, some of the bowls and stuff, there are some switchbacks around, but a lot of times it's like you're going up. It felt like AT and it, like parts of Maine and stuff, and a lot of that. It was like, oh God, we're going up, and here's some rebar ladder for you to climb, or you know, there was one spot in close to the Mediterranean. I was going up one of the last like tall mountains. It's called Canigou, one of the tallest mountains in the eastern Pyrenees. And it was there was a chimney. There's like this pinch where it does switch back you up a ways, but then you get to this pinch where you're climbing. I guess in the 1900s, some of the early European alpinists like blew up this chimney, basically, that you could get up into, but it's a good like 200, 300 feet where you're rock climbing, you're free soloing essentially. Like, and what's crazy is it's really popular. So there are like dozens of people doing this at a time. And it's like, oh, it was madness, man. Like I passed like 3 groups that were, you know, frozen up and freaking out, because it's like, it's high consequence. Like it's super, super technical shit. And these people are like going up with like and I'm toned and like trying to move and make distance and stuff. So I'm like moving, and like It was chaos. I wouldn't want to go the other direction. Going down would have been even more madness. Like going up was challenging enough, but like
that many people in the same chute. I mean, one person slips and that could be all they wrote for a whole bunch of people.
That's just it. Yeah, absolutely. Crazy. I can show you. I'll send some pictures on that one
because
it's a riot. Like it was just wild. And
so what was your biggest takeaway from the HRP? Let me think back on it.
It's an amazing, amazing trail. The Pyrenees are at the top of my mountain ranges now. Like that I did the Camino in 2017. That one I left out of my trail list, but I hiked from Zurich, Switzerland to the coast of Spain in that trip, but I went over the Pyrenees. On the Camino, you just go up and then you go down, and that's it. You're out and you're in the flatlands of Spain. And this traveling the spine of the Pyrenees is one of the coolest like mountain range hikes you can imagine. It's like being in the winds for an extended period of time, or like it felt like Himalayas, or like it was at the top of those mountain ranges. And what's cool is that like even in high season there aren't a whole lot of people out there. Like you get to some of the huts that are a little easier accessibility or are on one of the GRs, the GR10 or the GR11. And there's people out there. You'll have that community. You'll come together and eat a dinner with a dozen or two dozen people. Or there was one time where the hut was complete. There were a couple of times where the huts were just full with school groups or like, you know, a big hiking group. That just takes over. But on trail, I mean, I was lucky to see a couple of people every day kind of thing. There's not a lot of people out there. And every time you come up to a ridge, every time you get to a high point, it's just like, whoa. Like there are no such thing as PUDs on the HRP. There's no pointless ups and downs. When you go up, it's, you're seeing a whole new landscape, a whole new take on a valley or a set of a range or some high peaks around you. And it's just breathtaking. And beyond that, there's the history behind it all too. You've got like thousands of years of conquests that have washed up against those mountains and the Roman roads, you'll cross or follow Roman roads from time to time that people tried to tame these mountains like 3,000 years ago and barely did it. You know, they got across and maybe put a road down, but like they didn't hold it.
During all those conquests, it'd be good to be living in Andorra.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah.
They held their own and through a lot of that. It's spectacular. And to be able to like walk into a hut and a lot of times, especially on the French side, I would sleep outside. I wouldn't pay for the inside. I don't, the whole snoring and being inside thing is like, I'd rather be in my tent where it's quiet and I'm not bothering anybody when I wrestle around, you know, like it's, so I'd often get to a hut and pay for dinner, which is like a 3-course European meal with a carafe of wine for like 10 or 15 euros. And we're talking like good wine too, you know, you can get beers too, but like the wine is, especially on the Spain side, is like, you can get a liter for 3 euros, 4 euros. They joke that the wine is cheaper than water. Like you have to buy water, good water, bottled water where you go, and the wine is cheaper than the water is. Like, and the food is really good, and you get, when you come together in those huts, that's where the hiker culture kind of comes out. There's a lot of internationals. A lot of times English is the common language, so you end up
Well, Enigma, you've got me sold on the HRP. I'm missing out not having done that yet.
Couldn't say enough good things about it. Really, really an amazing trail that's not really a big focus these yet. Like I think it's starting to become more of one for the European hikers, but as far as the American through hiker culture goes, it doesn't seem like a lot of people have gotten after that one yet. And I think that'll change, because like, especially as people hike the trails and kind of check them off, like you start looking abroad. The Tiara is, of course, a massive draw and has gotten a lot of popularity. But then if you're looking at Europe, like, and you don't want to do the Camino, your other options are the Alps or the Pyrenees, and there's a lot more people in the Alps. The Pyrenees, you have a lot less people, and it's just as incredible, just as breathtaking.
Yeah, I have to let my listeners in on a little secret here about you. You are really living up to your trail name, Enigma, because when we were setting up this interview, you know, we in our exchange, we talked about, okay, let's talk about the HRP and the Via Dinarica. And so I had no insight into what other types of activities you've been involved in. And now I find out tonight, this very evening, I find out tonight that you are a triple crowner, that you've done the Camino, that you've done the Pacific Northwest Trail. You've done how many thousands of miles do you have under your feet, Enigma?
Around 13, I think.
Okay.
13 to 15, I think, at this point. If you want some more, there's... I spent a year in college in New Zealand. This was before the Te Aroha was established as a trail, but I did get to do a fair bit of trekking when I was in New Zealand. I did more snowboarding because I was there in like fall, winter, spring, so I didn't get the summer months as much. Tried to do some hiking though. Got a little bit there. After that trip, I went up into Southeast Asia and spent 4 months in Nepal. So I got to do like Annapurna circuit and did some trekking in Ganesh Himal. I didn't do the Everest base camp trek, but I still got out and did some Himalaya expeditions, which was super fun too. And then the year that I did the Camino, I did it kind of strangely in that I started in the middle of France and hiked to the coast of Spain. Then I went and did something else for a couple of months. Then I went back to Europe and took a train out to Zurich and then hiked from Zurich back to that place that I started in the middle of France. And for those couple of months in between, I went out to Armenia and Georgia and worked on the Transcaucasian Trail that's being constructed out there. And so I got to do some route finding and hiking of what they've established over there, which was super, super, super cool as well. And happy to see that it's getting very well established at this point. More people are starting to take that one on. I got to get in the Caucasus on that trip too.
Any time in South America, Patagonia?
Not yet. It's that and Iceland are kind of the top of the list for the international stuff right now for me.
Okay. Now, in all of your travels, I mean, what is your preference? American trails or European trails or New Zealand?
Well, I like the international trails for the adventure aspect of it. Cause you're having to navigate languages and, just there's less people. It's much more of the adventure feel around it. What I like about the American hiking is the community and the culture that's on the trails out here. You don't find that anywhere else, from what I've experienced. Small bits, little pieces and parts, and it's very like intimate little groups of people every once in a while, but it's nothing like what's going on in the States. And I love the community of hikers. It's part of the addiction for me. It's part of what keeps me hiking is that I've made some of the best friends I have on the trails. You know, I've the kindness from strangers gives you faith in humanity and in these weird times we're living through right now. I love that about it. So I couldn't choose one or the other. If the international scene had the culture that the American scene is, it would be easy. If the U.S. culture was a little bit more wild, maybe I'd tend towards that. But I don't know. It's hard to both have their benefits, their pluses for sure. Well,
there's certain parts of the U.S. it feels like you're talking a different language to folks, you know, with their
sometimes
and accents and yeah.
Yeah, but it's nothing like being like the Via Dinarica, which like a lot of the countries along the Via Dinarica speak variations of the same language. It's all kind of Slavic based. So Croatian is really, really similar to Slovenian, is really, really similar to Bosnian and Montenegrin. They all are kind of similar, but then like you cross into Albania and it's a whole different thing. You start to see the Cyrillic writing on all the street signs, and it's like, you know, you're dealing with a completely different language. So yeah, and on that trail, less people speak English, especially up in the rural areas. So there is no common language kind of situation, and it makes it a lot more challenging to communicate. Google Translate is a godsend for us. Like it's a game changer in a big way to be able to just speak into the phone and hold it up in an instant translation kind of things. Pure magic.
How long before we have the earpieces that instantly translate what people are saying to us?
You know, I think they're here. Actually, I think I saw a video about some startup that's got one an earpiece that does 15 languages or something like that.
So crazy.
We're close.
Yep. Hey, Enigma, you know where we are right now?
Planet Earth.
We are. That's a safe guess. Yeah, planet Earth. But
the pro tip insight of the week.
Are at that time of the episode where we're going to talk about the pro tip insight of the week. It's your turn to share some trail wisdom with our listeners to make their next outdoor experience even better. We're going to have to put a pin in the Via Dinarica topic. We'll come back to that on another episode after you've done the Hey Duke. We'll bring you back on. We'll talk about the Hey Duke. We'll talk about Via Dinarica and some other adventures. But what do you have for us in terms of a pro tip?
Pro tip, cloud watch. Get good at cloud watching. Become a cloud watcher. Don't be ashamed to like kick back and watch the clouds and learn what they do. Learn their language. That'll change your experience and get you into a lot more safe hiking, better risk assessment. You'd be able to know. It's simple things like seeing scaly clouds, knowing that it's going to rain the next day kind of thing, or knowing when that thunderstorm's building up before it starts booming so that you can plan your day accordingly. Like if you get good at watching the clouds and watching the way the winds are blowing, and the moisture in the air, you can have a safer experience hiking, I think. So I guess that would be my pro tip, is become a cloud watcher.
You know, when you started that whole conversation, I was thinking you were being kind of fanciful. Watch the clouds, enjoy the moment, you know, what shapes can you see up there? And you took a turn to me. I wasn't expecting that.
There's that too. There's beauty in it for sure, and it grounds you and brings you a little bit more into the moment and takes you out of thinking about the other stuff. But there's practicality to watching the clouds too.
Yes, very much so. Okay, so there you have it. That's it. This episode is just about in the books. Hope our listeners enjoyed our time with Enigma. Want to thank him for joining us this week. Dylan, where can our listeners keep up with you on social media, and how can they find updates on your latest adventures?
Well, I'm on the trek. We mentioned that at the beginning. I did blog out last summer's stuff. I might try and do more in the future. It's a, you know, stay tuned as far as that goes. I am much more active on Instagram. You'll tag me on the social media stuff. But if you're listening to the podcast or if you're watching on YouTube, my Instagram handle is @dill_on_dice with periods between dill and on and dice. And that's spelled D-I-C-E, like the laughing bones, your gambling instruments. That's the best way to keep in touch. I'm on Facebook too, but I'm not real active over there, and everything that gets posted there gets posted on Instagram first. So
Life, do you go by Enigma? Do you go by Dill? Do you go by Dylan?
I go by Dylan with friends and family around town. On Facebook, I'm Jack in the Green. So there's a lot of people that know me as Jack these days. I've had other nicknames too, but that kind of.
Yeah, I think in the three or four emails that we exchanged, each one seemed to come with a different name attached to it. Like, who am I talking to this time?
A man of many names is part of the enigma. That's
right. That's right.
It all boils down to that, and that's, I guess, why I've kept that one too. I went by. That's another name. On the AT, I decided to choose a name and go by something a little different. I was one a day on the AT, trying to keep my mindset of like doing something unique every day. It was my one a day tendency to try and like, you know, just to change it up, you know, go climb on this or go out on a boat over here, you know, like.
I see multiple episodes in our future as we go through these different stories, you know, one a day, your Triple Crown experience, the Hey Dude.
I'm happy to talk more. And yeah, I'd love to tell you about the Via Dinarica, because there's a lot to that. Yeah. There's a lot to that. And
well, you did such a great job selling the HRP. I mean, we really got a good idea of that. I think Via Dinarica deserves its own episode.
All right. Well, let's do it.
Okay.
Let me know when you want to. You can send me an email anytime you'd like.
I know how to find you.
You do.
Remember to check out the pod on social media as well. We are on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you have comments or clips you want to share, you can send it to me at johnfreakingmuir@gmail.com.
The Adventure Media Recommendation.
All right, Enigma. I'm also looking to you to share a recommendation for a book, a movie, documentary, some kind of outdoor media to keep our listeners connected to the trail. Call this our Adventure Media Recommendation. What do you have?
This one was hard, and I said I was going to think about this one more for a better answer, and I neglected to do that, unfortunately. The first thing that comes to mind right now is Read Edward Abbey. Hey Dude keeps coming up, and didn't get to get there with the Via Dinarica, but Hey Duke is actually a Slavic word, and it was borrowed from that language. It translates to outlaw, to ruffian, which is, you know, what that character was in the Edward Abbey books. But read Edward Abbey, read Wendell Berry, read those authors that really celebrate nature and being in nature. John Muir, of course.
Do you have a favorite Edward Abbey title?
I mean, the Monkey Ranch Gang is an easy go-to, but Desert Solitaire is also high on the list.
Nice. I'm smiling because this is second episode in a row we've had a little conversation about Edward Abbey. I love it.
Right.
Monkey Ranch Gang is awesome. What an impact.
Yeah. I've been reading a lot of Wendell Berry actually these days, and he wasn't a hiker. He settled into landscape and celebrated his own place rather than being out in moving through places, but kind of a similar celebration of the wilderness. Not quite as wry as Abbey is. Abbey's definitely a little bit more of a curmudgeon. Berry's a little bit more celebratory.
Okay.
But it's all part of the same game. We gotta pay attention to our environmental world and celebrate it, you know, and and talk about it because we're losing it too quickly. So
yeah, well said. Well said.
What have we not asked you?
All right. And before we wrap things up, one more segment called What Have I Not Asked You That You're Dying to Tell Us About? What do we miss?
Yeah, well, we missed the whole Via Dinarica, but I guess some of the like logistical stuff about traveling in Europe and hiking in Europe. You have a 3-month limit in the Schengen zone. You have to do what you're going to do in these 32 countries that constitute the Schengen visa agreement within a period of, 90 days. I think I just said 30 days. 90 days, 3 months. You can leave and come back, but if it's within 180 days, you only have 90 days within those 180 days. If you go somewhere else and exceed that 180 days, you start over and you have another 90 days. So that's a major consideration when if you're planning to do something like the HRP or the Via Dinarica now. Well, before Slovenia was part of Schengen, now Croatia is also part of Schengen. They just joined in January, just a couple months ago. So that's you do have to take those kinds of things into consideration. For me, it took 45 days to do the HRP. So that, you know, it leave, and I think, and that was kind of low end. If you're a fast through hiker, you can do it in less. You could do it in 30, 35 days. If you want to do 5 or 10 miles a day, every day, you can do it in 50 or 60 days. All that being said, you can do the HRP and plan for a couple of weeks before and after to do some sightseeing in Europe if you want to. But if you're trying to do like a longer distance trail or do some kind of connection to the Alps or a circuit through the Iberian or something fancy like that, you do have to take that 90-day time limit into consideration. So that is an important part of the hiking in Europe thing that we missed, is okay. The timing. That's about it.
Very good, sir. Well, that is a wrap from the John Freakymer studio. Any shout outs to friends and family, Enigma?
Family doesn't really pay much attention to this stuff, so probably not. If any family do happen to listen, thanks. As far as Hiker Trash goes, wanted to congratulate Magpie and Constantine. They just finished up the Tiroa. So if they're listening, good on ya. And wishing luck to Waldo and Artemis if they happen to listen. They're the friends that are going out on the Hey Duke probably a couple weeks now. So the good luck on that. I hope it's not too snowy out there. And for all the PCT hikers this year, you're freaking insane if you're thinking about doing the PCT this year, but please be safe. Know when to bail and get it. Like, have a good time, but be safe out there.
Yeah, I just saw a headline just this evening. Saw a headline, highest snowpack in the Southern Sierra in recorded history.
I believe it. Yeah, it's going to be an insane year because the melt-off's going to be hard too. It's going to get hot in the summer because it's global warming and it's going to be hot. And now that's going to melt. So those rivers are going to
be careful swollen. On the river crossings. That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
A couple of years ago, like 2017 was another big snow year. And had a couple of friends who attempted it that year and got to the Sierras and were like, nah, it's just... And people, I think 3 or 4 people died that year in river crossing. So, yeah, don't be that person. Back off when it's dangerous and take some time off or do it another year. It's okay.
It's another pro tip for you right there. Enigma, yeah, seriously. Just dropping them left and right.
At this point, I think I have a few. But I'm also no expert. I make mistakes too. I'm always learning.
All right. Well, hey, thank you for tuning in. Always remember, the trail is the trail. It doesn't care if you want to go downhill. It doesn't care if it's almost dark and you're looking for a campsite. It doesn't even care if you've got 200,000 feet of elevation gain in front of you on the HRP. The trail is the trail. Embrace the suck. ¶¶